50 years from now, if someone were to create a museum about how immigrants into New York City live in 2014, what would it be like? Annie Pollan, Vice President of Programs and Education at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum, has posed this question in order to get people to think about housing standards for the city's poorest newcomers, and she joins us now to talk about an article she has written for the Huffington Post called What Would a Tenement Museum Opening in 2064 Look Like? Welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Did you get good answers to the question?
I haven't had any answers yet, but this started out in September of last year at the Tenement Museum, and we were hosting a book party for a new book called One Out of Three, which refers to the fact that one out of three New Yorkers is an immigrant now, and edited by Nancy Foner. And we had an array of academics and journalists, and I kind of threw that question out, and I said, what would this look like? And they said a basement apartment in Queens, and that caught me by surprise, and I started looking into it.
Well, you say one in three residents of New York is an immigrant?
That's correct.
Right now?
Actually, 37%, yes. So a little bit over one.
I would assume some of them have a lot of money. Not all of them are poor.
That's correct.
But I think that probably was always the case. Who did you ask this? Did you ask the people who might have come out of a poor background or people who were
rather comfortable? Well, the people who were on the panel, Nancy Foner, a sociologist here in New York, Phil Kasnitz, Suketu Mehta also, who's a journalist, and they were the ones who kind of responded.
Later we will invite our listeners to give us what they think, their answers. Our number here is 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. The Lower East Side Tenement Museum shows how immigrants lived about 120 years ago. Can you tell us about the neighborhood that you're in the late 1800s?
Sure. By 1900, the Lower East Side was the most densely populated neighborhood in the country. Some people argue the world. And it was filled, stacked with tenement apartments, which were essentially 5-6-story buildings with about 4 apartments per floor. Averaged in 1900, about 100 people per building. Our building at 97 Orchard had 111 residents in 1900.
But it wasn't the only place where immigrants came. I once read that 1 in 7 Americans can trace their family back to Brooklyn at one point or another.
That's correct. Brownsville also was a really important immigrant neighborhood at the time.
And then later the Bronx, I'm assuming. And then Queens, of course, has had some major immigrant neighborhoods. So have people just moved around? Have the immigrant neighborhoods moved around? What is the Lower East Side like now? Isn't it still an immigrant neighborhood?
It still is an immigrant neighborhood, although nowhere near what it was 100 years ago. So 100 years ago, and even before that, you could talk about the Lower East Side as the primary destination for many immigrant groups over time, the Irish, the Germans, and then the Jews and the Italians.
They came off of Ellis Island and wound up in the Lower East Side?
Exactly, or Little Italy. But what changed really was the 1924 immigration law, which had very restrictive quotas. And so that stopped that stream of immigration. And in 1965, when the laws were changed, at that point, Manhattan was in many ways filled up. And so people still continued to come to Manhattan, but started to go to Queens and started to go to Brooklyn in heavier numbers, in larger numbers.
Except northern Manhattan, which developed a big Dominican population, for example. Has that flow stopped?
No, that continues. That continues. So if you looked at, and we're actually creating these charts right now for an interactive, if you look at a map of the 5 boroughs, say, in 1920, you can see that there's immigration, the heavy immigration on the Lower East Side. If you look at it in 2010, you see it's really shifted. There's a little bit in Washington Heights, a little bit in Chinatown, but you really see Queens and Brooklyn popping up as the areas of heavy immigrant density.
Including the Chinatowns in Flushing and in Brooklyn, but also Sunset Park, where we're seeing a lot of Mexicans and other Latinos. Are the tenements just as terrible now? What was a tenement like in the Lower East Side 120 years ago?
Yeah, and I also see that where you're going, perhaps, is to that, you really could create a tenement museum anywhere in New York City. Well, there are some exceptions, but there are so many neighborhoods and so many buildings that have so many layers that you can trace the story of immigration and the story of changing housing. The Lower East Side, though, I think you could say is unique in the sense just because of the sheer numbers and because at the turn of the 20th century, it became a focus of progressive reformers who really kind of honed in on the Lower East Side as a gold mine of social experimentation, where you could take such terrible conditions and say, it's so terrible here, what can we do, and let's experiment.
And Jacob Riis brought the living conditions of the tenements to the country's attention with his photographs and his essay, How the Other Half Lives. It made him so celebrated that they named a park after him.
Yes, and it is also the number one selling book, I believe, in our shop at the Tenement Museum. I mean, we do this every day for hundreds of visitors. We have about 200,000 visitors a year, and so many know Jacob Riis. I mean, he's taught to the school children. He has kind of emerged as someone who still is very prominent in people's minds.
What do you think the predominance of visitors to the Tenement Museum are they people whose families are mostly people whose families settled in the Lower East Side, or are they people interested in tracing their own family backgrounds, or is it just people who are interested in the history of America?
A little bit of everything, but I would say that we have two distinct groups. We have public visitors, many of whom are the grandchildren and great-grandchildren of immigrants who we depict in our building, Irish, Russian, Jewish, Italian, German. But we also have about 50,000 school children who come every year. And the majority of these children are in New York City public schools, and they are immigrants or the children of immigrants. So the story resonates for people no matter where they are in terms of how many generations they've been in the country.
And how do they react when they see how people live back then?
You know, it's a mix. We always joke about how we can tell who New Yorkers are, because when we lead them into apartments, typically 325 square feet, there are
with
some...
With the bathroom outside.
With the bathroom in the hallway, exactly. Two toilets in the hall. And those toilets weren't even there until after 1901. So people come in, and the New Yorkers don't react. You can see in their head, they're thinking about where they can put their IKEA furniture to make the best of that. But people from outside, and we have a third of our visitors are from outside New York, and they gasp just at the size, and they don't even see this. They don't smell the smells. They don't see the labor that was there until we kind of bring that forward in our stories.
We have a call from John, who lives on the Lower East Side. Hi, John.
Hello, Leonard. I just recently was to the Tenement Museum, and yes, they did talk about 325 square feet, three little rooms, which suddenly reminded me that a year ago I went up to the Museum of the City of New York to see the new housing that was going to be built, affordable housing for young people to continue to live in Manhattan. At least one building is going to be built this way. You know what it was? 325 square feet.
Exactly.
Basically, two rooms. Mm-hmm. There was a dining room, living room that pulled out of the wall, the table. The other was the bed pulled out of the wall, and there was the office. And in between there was an aisle, which was the kitchen, just a counter on either side of an aisle. So in 150 years, we've come full circle.
Yeah, although you're absolutely right. The one thing I would say is that these new studio apartments, part of the Bloomberg administration ideas, that these are geared to young singles moving into the city. So another stream of migration, right? So we have all these young people, college educated, moving into the city. They need an affordable place to live, and this is the answer. So you're absolutely right. The only difference is that when we talk about conditions 100 years ago, you have to imagine 8 or 10 people living in 325 square feet as opposed to, you know, a young accountant. Who's
a whole nuclear family would be there.
Not even just nuclear. So nuclear, if you're lucky, you have a nuclear family. Many, we have, seven out of 10 of the families that were in 1900 in our building had boarders. So you had a single man or single woman, maybe two of them, renting out space within the tenement to get by, people who had come from your hometown.
What brought so many immigrants to New York City in the 19th century? Are we seeing similar things today with the new immigrants?
Definitely. I mean, the immigrants were coming in the 19th century because they needed economic opportunity. They needed work. A similar thing is happening today. What has changed a little bit is that when there are at the turn of the 20th century, there were a lot of jobs in manufacturing, and that doesn't exist in the same way.
Well, there are many more affordable cities to live in than New York. Is it difficult for poor immigrants to find affordable housing?
Well, I think it's difficult for many people to find affordable housing in New York, right? Which is why de Blasio was able to get so much support when he talked about A Tale of Two Cities. But New York is expensive. But New York is attractive today, just as it was 100 years ago, because so many people already have networks here. You can get your newspaper in your language. You can be part of a real faith-based community.
You can find food from the old country.
You can find food from the old country, and you can find homes, because people are living in homes. And this is what these basement apartments were about. Many of them are family units where people are renting out the basements of people they might know or people from their country. So the same thing, you know, that happened on the Lower East Side 100 years ago is happening in many ways in neighborhoods like Jackson Heights.
How much was the rent for a typical apartment on Orchard Street in 1880?
In the 1880s? $12.
Well, what would that be in current dollars?
I can't tell you that a lot. But what I can tell you is that more than 25%, it took up more than 25 to 30% of people's income was going to rent, which is, you know, similar today. In some ways, you could say today is even harder.
When Rees published his photographs and his essay, and others also got involved, what reaction was there from the people who, I guess, were unaware of this? This was kind of a hidden problem, wasn't it?
It was. And people like Jacob Rees and Lawrence Vaylor were incredibly important because they raised public awareness to these issues. So Rees did it with his photographs. Lawrence Vaylor, who was a housing reform advocate, hosted an exhibition, the Tenement House Exhibition, in February of 1900 at Sherry's Restaurant, which was an uptown exclusive place where they had a ballroom and everything. And what he did is he set up 1,000 photographs, many of which were Jacob Rees photos, charts, graphs, and a cardboard diorama depicting a single block of tenements on the Lower East Side bounded by Bayard Canal, Christian Forsyth, and showed that there were, in this one block, 2,781 people, only 264 toilets, no bathtubs, 32 cases of tuberculosis, and 66, I think, many, many cases of people who had applied for charity. So he showed in this diorama how bad the conditions were, but he also showed that those conditions, people were paying a lot of money for those conditions because this block took in about $113,000 a year in income, in rental income. So he was able to make a case to the middle class that this housing situation was terrible and it was a drain on resources because ultimately these are the people who are getting sick. These are the people who have to apply to charity. So it was really important what Vaylor and Rees did to raise awareness.
And led to the 1901 tenement law. We will come back to that and to the to some of the answers to Annie Pollan's question, what would a tenement museum opening in 2064 look like? She is Vice President of Programs and Education at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. Stay with us for more. We are back with Annie Pollan, Vice President of Programs and Education at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum, who has posed the question, what would a tenement museum opening in 2064 look like? It has been published by the Huffington Post, and we have invited her on our show to think about this, and we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. What changes did the 1901 tenement law call for?
Well, many very important laws, many important changes. One is that they said that new tenements being built had to be built on larger lots and had to have larger courtyards to allow for more air and light.
Was there the limit of six-story walk-up?
Yes. And then what was really important, especially concerning our building, which was built, which was pre-existing, a lot of the new laws were not retroactive until 1901. And the 1901 law was retroactive. So what it did is it said that all these tenements, no matter when they were built, they had to be brought up to a certain standard or code, which involved indoor plumbing, which involved bathrooms inside. So to kind of give concrete expression to this, at 97 Orchard, the 1901 law meant that people were no longer using restrooms outside. They were inside, two per floor. There was now running water. The hallway now had gas lighting so people could see where they were going.
There'd be bathtubs in the kitchen?
Yes. Well, in bathtubs kind of in sinks, these large. So it was a huge change for the people who were living there. Yet the conditions continued to be problematic.
How did the landlords deal with it?
They weren't so happy about it, right? So the landlords, because it's great to have all these changes, but the landlords had to pay for these changes out of their own pockets. And so the landlords at 97 Orchard, for example, paid about $8,000 to make these changes, which was not an insignificant sum, given that they had paid maybe $21,000 for the whole building a year or two before that.
But weren't many of the landlords immigrants?
Correct.
Themselves.
Right, they were.
They didn't see what they were doing as taking advantage of people who are going through the same thing they had gone through earlier?
I think another way, they probably looked at it like, I went through this and I am trying to get out of this by getting involved in real estate. And the landlords themselves were under tremendous pressure because they had taken out these loans to kind of do, and they needed to pay back there. So it was an incredibly, competitive and tense situation. They did make the changes, and one of the things that was really important that was part of this law was that they mandated tenement housing inspectors, a department that would go and inspect these buildings and make sure that they were being enforced. So we actually have a program at the museum called Tenement Inspectors, where kids take on the role of the inspectors and investigate the building.
Have we resolved these things? Because people are still debating what fair housing for the city's poor should be, who should pay for it, and where it should be located.
Right. I mean, Theodore Roosevelt, who was then governor of New York, when the tenement housing exhibition opened, he said something to the effect of that people are going to continue to suffer. We're going to continue to make changes. This is an ongoing process that that we're involved in, so that the next generations are going to have to take up the mantle to make sure that housing continues to be regulated and continues to be accessible. So today, you have an issue where you have about maybe 500,000 New Yorkers living in these basement apartments, which are actually not regulated. And so there are issues there with regard to fire hazards and safety and so on and so forth.
We have a call from Joe, who also could be called Giuseppe. He's from Port Washington. Hi.
Hello.
You were born right down the block from the Tenement Museum?
Yes, at 80 Orchard Street. I wonder if the 96 is between Stanton and Grant Street or between Stanton and Houston.
Well, 97 Orchard is actually between Broome and Delancey. So you're
Broome and Delancey. All right, I know where that is.
Yeah.
Well, where I was born was between Stanton and Houston on Orchard Street, and literally in a top floor cold water flat apartment, midwife and the rest of it.
Oh, well, we would love to interview you, so come and visit us.
Did you see changes over the years that you were there?
Well, what happened is I left for the military at rather young age, but I did see changes, sure, from the struggle that my parents had, and my father got a fairly good job, and this was before World War II. He was a civilian employee of the U.S. Navy prior to World War II, so things changed considerably. To the extent that they bought property in New Jersey, and eventually, while I was away in the military, they did move there, and yes, they told me where they moved to.
Mm-hmm. So that you knew where to come back to.
Exactly.
But your parents were Italian immigrants?
Well, yes, from Sicily.
Uh-huh.
My mother came at age 5, and my father was 19, and his parents sent him here. They had military conscription in Italy at that time, and his two brothers were severely wounded in World War II. World War I, and she didn't want that possibility to ever happen to my father. So they got together what they needed and sent him off to America.
And then you wound up in the U.S. military anyway.
Well, that was voluntarily, yes. I went into the Air Force.
Well, thank you so much for calling us.
can tell you one thing. Yeah,
and by the way, if your parents came here today, where do you think that they would settle?
If they came here today from Sicily?
Yes.
It depends how they were financially.
In New York.
But probably in Manhattan, lower Manhattan.
But did they come with a lot of money when they had over originally?
No, had very, very modest means. Very modest. My mother at that age was working. My grandmother would bring work home from the shop where she worked, and my mother would sit on the floor and sewing these garments at age 5. Mm-hmm. And my father worked at whatever he could do, watchman, anything, you know, shoveling snow, anything. And then eventually they never did have any type of, they called it home relief at that time, mm-hmm. any kind of assistance, nothing.
Joe, all thank you so own. Much for calling us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
And we have another call. This one's from Sharon from Asbury Park. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm listening to this program, and I'm interested in hearing some things about the economic development. I think that the garment district was getting started at that time, and I'd like to know what other kind of jobs are available to these people. And I also like to know about the crime. The immigrants turned Brooklyn and Lower Manhattan into a hotbed of crime, and I wonder if you're going to touch on that. Murder, Inc., for example, and I believe that was the era of Arnold Rothstein. In fact, Rothstein's father started one of the first garment factories down there.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Tongs, pretty much every immigrant group had a certain involvement in crime initially because it was hard to make a living any other way.
And the tenements, it's a great connection back to the tenements because one of the things that Vaylor and other progressive reformers argued is that the conditions bred crime, right? If you're raising people in terrible, unsanitary, overcrowded conditions where, you know, prostitution is rife and there's gambling and all of this, it's kind of that the kids in many ways don't have a lot of hope. This is what they were saying in 1900. So in many ways, they said we need better housing because better housing and better conditions are actually going to create better citizens. And citizens all over New York, whether they're middle class, upper class, whether they had immigrants who came, their forebears had came a generation ago or four generations ago, the progressive reformers argued that we're all as a city responsible for kind of lifting up the citizenship and the housing and that went hand in hand.
We have pretty much run out of time, but there are organizations like the Chaya Community Development Corporation who are trying to address some of the problems for recent immigrants. One of the problems, as I see it, is that apartments keep on being broken up into smaller and smaller units, which sounds very much like what was happening in the Lower East Side.
Exactly. And they're doing
not talking about those rich kids who are coming here to New York to settle into New York.
No. And they're dealing with this housing in a really wonderful way that's kind of akin to what the reformers were doing in the sense that they're studying, they're canvassing the neighborhood, they're coming up with suggestions that kind of meet the needs of both the tenants, the landlords, and the city. So these reports, I think, are akin to what the Tenement House Exhibition was in 1901.
Annie Pollan's article in Huffington Post is, "What Would a Tenement Museum Opening in 2064 Look Like?" She is the Vice President of Programs and Education at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.